Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 10th of May with me, Ian Welsh. A bumper episode this week. Recently I spoke with Lisa Speaker de Bevacqua from Auditor and Certifiers NSF International about trends in sustainability regulation and how companies can navigate their way through the compliance and beyond compliance challenges. And I also spoke with Mike Shoemaker from Farm Data Analyst Sveda about the ever-increasing importance of regenerative agriculture, what's driving the transition, and why we need to be aware of an over-focus on carbon. That's all to come. First, though, is a quick roundup of some sustainable business news. UK supermarket chain Waitrose has announced a commitment to support more than 2,000 UK farmers to move to nature-friendly farming practices, helping to boost long-term farm financial resilience and combat the effects of climate change. Waitrose will work with the farms to produce food that it says works in harmony with nature and to source meat, milk, eggs, fruit and vegetables from UK farms which use regenerative practices by 2035. Waitrose plans to enable access to affordable finance and provide resources to support farm transition to regenerative and low-carbon farming. It will provide access to market for regeneratively produced food in Waitrose shops and online, and provide practical tools, workshops, online resources and mentoring to help farmers make the shift to regenerative agriculture. The supermarket has also pledged to develop understanding of regenerative practices across different supply chains, tailored to farming types, and then scale these into supply chains, complete a state of nature assessment by 2026 of all own brand UK farms, and create land management plans so that farmers and growers can improve priority habitats and support thriving biodiversity. And finally, Waitrose will undertake field trials and new innovative practices at one of its farms, which will help inform approaches to regenerative practices in its supply chains. Renewables generated a record 30% of global electricity in 2023, driven by growth in solar and wind, according to the latest Global Electricity Review from Ember. With record construction of solar and wind in 2023, the report says that a new era of falling fossil generation is imminent and speculates that 2023 was likely the pivot point, marking peak emissions in the power sector. Ember says that the expansion of capacity would have been enough to deliver a fall in global power sector emissions in 2023. However, drought caused a five-year low in hydropower, which created a shortfall that was met in large part by coal. Nonetheless, latest forecasts give confidence that 2024 will begin a new era of falling fossil generation, marking 2023 as the likely peak of power sector emissions, according to the research. Solar is leading the way. It was the fastest growing source of electricity generation for the 19th year in a row, and surpassed wind to become the largest source of new electricity for the second year running. Indeed, solar added more than twice as much new electricity as coal in 2023. Global electricity demand rose to a record high in 2023, the report says, with an increase of 627 terawatt hours, which is equivalent to adding the entire demand of Canada. Nevertheless, the 2023 increase of 2.2% was below the average for recent years due to a pronounced decrease in demand in OECD countries, notably the US, which was down 1.4%, and the EU down 3.4%. In contrast, the rapid demand growth in China, up 6.9%, was equivalent to the total global growth in demand in 2023. The Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market has announced that the Verified Carbon Standard, operated by Verra, the world's largest carbon crediting programme, has met the High Integrity Core Carbon Principles, or CCPs, after making significant changes to its procedures. Verra had been subject to criticism in 2023 that some of the carbon projects it had certified were not meeting the standards claimed. Programmes operated by the Integrity Council have all made changes to the way they operate to comply with the High Integrity CCP criteria. Verra's VCS introduced a new programme to monitor the performance of the independent assessors of projects, updated its grievance procedure to ensure impartiality, and is committed to stronger sustainable development outcomes, including publishing the results of benefit-sharing arrangements with local communities. The CCPs set the first global benchmark for high-integrity carbon credits. The Integrity Council says that they are designed to build trust in the voluntary carbon market and introduce standardisation, providing a strong foundation of integrity that will enable the market to scale and maximise its potential to tackle rising greenhouse gas emissions. Their rigorous criteria are designed to provide assurance that CCP-labelled credits each represent a tonne of emissions reduced or removed from the atmosphere, and that they finance projects that bring sustainable development and biodiversity benefits. Recently, I spoke with Mike Shoemaker, CEO of agricultural data analyst VEDA, about what the right approach to regenerative agriculture looks like and how to balance profit and impact. Why don't you start by giving us a very quick introduction to what VEDA does?
VEDA is an agronomic services and technology company. So what we do is we design and execute regenerative management plans, and we really focus on partnering with the grower in a way that protects their yields while systematically driving down their input requirements. So we help them use regenerative practices to create natural forms of soil fertility, weed, pest, disease suppression. And then we actually trial all of this. We have currently two R&D and demonstration farms, large scale, totaling together about 5,300 acres, where we trial all of these practices and develop the applied agronomic science that we then take to growers so that they can be successful with regenerative ag. I'll say we're a certified B Corporation, which is important to us. We're also institutionally backed, and we leverage a lot of technology and data. We believe we're able to provide something unique to an industry that is seeking scalable technical assistance for regen ag programs that have really large ambitions.
Okay, so everyone's talking about regen agriculture right now. How do you characterize where the sector is?
There is a huge amount of enthusiasm, and it seems to me that it's only growing. I've been at a conference this week where, in fact, I would say that sustainability and regenerative ag are not just one theme. It's a broad ag conference. It's not focused on sustainability. It's now sort of just deeply integrated into the conversation. It's sort of clear that this is where the sector needs to go. And that makes sense if you put agriculture into the broader context of industry transition and transformation as a result of climate change and climate action and policy. I think most people listening know it contributes more than 20% of global emissions. It's just a sector that must transition, and it will. And we see regenerative agriculture, these practices, as being the renewables equivalent for agriculture. This is how we can meet the needs of the world in terms of food, feed, fuel, fiber, do so in a way that really helps to heal the planet. We're very excited about it, but I think like a lot of others, we see that we're very early stage as an industry. Yeah, and we're trying to go from really pilot scale to meaningful scale in terms of how this impacts the earth. Part of that is figuring out how do we go from the earliest adopters, the innovators and early adopters, to the middle of the adoption curve. I think that's one important dimension that people are working on. And then the other is how do we transition from trialing practices where you have growers that are trying this out and seeing if it works, to durable, sustainable practice change that can deliver real impact over many years. And so I think those are the two kind of challenges that we're collectively trying to sort out.
What do you think the right approach to regenerative agriculture looks like?
We have to understand that these practices are critical to solving the climate crisis without putting climate at the center of the conversation. So we think of regen practices as the means to the end, but actually the end isn't, ironically, climate. There was a venture investor I heard recently who said, climate's not your customer, that climate tech entrepreneurs need to remember climate's not your customers. And thinking about other industry transitions, there weren't a lot of people when electric vehicles and solar were nascent, there weren't a lot of people that went out and purchased those technologies just because it was clearly the right thing for the climate. It needed to make sense for the consumer of those technologies. We're in the business of focusing on making the practices pay, and not focused on paying for practices. We see that the incentives and that financial de-risking is a really critical part of the equation, but it can't be the reason why growers are doing it. It's not a sustainable approach to driving adoption and kind of long-term use of these practices.
What are the pitfalls that you're seeing that people should avoid?
There's an interesting mindset that needs to shift a little bit in terms of we can't go to growers and ask them to optimize for carbon. Carbon sequestration. I think in general, conservation, if you put regenerative agriculture in the conservation bucket, which a lot of growers do, they have come to understand conservation as something that is done at the expense of production. There's a strict trade-off between doing something that's good for the environment and good for your production, at least in the short term. We have to help people think about this differently and think about eliminating this idea of that strict trade-off, because regenerative practices bring with them the ability to drive profitability, drive the financial well-being of the farm at the same time that they're delivering these environmental benefits. And so, yeah, I think that's the first part. But for that to be real to a grower, for that promise to be realized, we actually have to get the agronomics right. We're in the early stages of deeply understanding how to optimize the use of these practices to drive financial and agronomic benefit at the farm level. That's one area where we spend a lot of our time. That's what our business is focused on. And we think that if we can get that right for growers, we'll deliver the environmental impacts, we'll deliver that sustainable practice change.
What about things to avoid then? Pitfalls, things that can go wrong?
We need to be careful about is if we're too preachy about this and we're trying to drive these practices strictly through monetary incentives without the right level of technical assistance and agronomic support, we risk burning the market. There's real risk, and you're seeing this in some cases where growers are trying these practices because they want to qualify for these programs and qualify for the payments. They're not doing the practices in a way that delivers that agronomic benefit and is even having negative impacts on production. And so what that obviously does is it puts the grower in a situation where they don't want to do them going forward, and they may not want to try them again in the future.
What's driving the regenerative transition then?
Clearly, from the industry perspective, it's decarbonization. That is very real, and it's important because the farmers sense it. The statistic is that 93% of farmers are aware of regenerative agriculture and carbon programs, but 3% have adopted. That 93% clearly see that there's a shift taking place. So they want to stay ahead of that. I think for the farm and for the grower, what's driving the regenerative transition is that farm level economics are broken. We're at a point where just continuing to push yields isn't going to make the farm financially better off. We actually have to find ways to drive down the input requirements of these farms to give them more space in their P&L to be able to deal with adversity and volatility. So they have this kind of meaningful buffer that both allows them to invest in the well-being of their farm and their communities and feed their families, but also gives them, again, that buffer in the farm's P&L to be able to deal with the uncertainty that comes with farming. I think that's where we see this interesting intersection of what the industry wants to see in terms of decarbonization and what the grower is struggling with at the farm level.
Do you think there's been an overfocus on carbon? There must be risks of doing that.
If you're thinking about transition finance mechanisms, you're thinking about how to incentivize this kind of work, carbon's the natural place to go because it's the most mature market in terms of ecosystem services. The risk is that carbon becomes the end unto itself again. It sort of becomes an industry, and in trying to figure out how to measure and verify and monetize soil carbon in agriculture, if that becomes the objective, then I think we miss the point because regenerative agriculture, as you know, is it can deliver meaningful benefits in terms of emissions reduction and sequestration. There's still some important questions around permanence, but it has tremendous potential to improve water efficiency, water usage at the farm or supply shed level, water quality. Biodiversity obviously is an important part of the puzzle. So I think we just have to be careful about not letting carbon become the end objective.
Do you think that markets will develop in other areas? I mean, is there going to be a nature-based solutions market, do you think?
You can look at different jurisdictions, different countries and states around the world. You can see where we've experimented with markets for different types of ecosystem services. So I think that both exists. It's also immature. There's plenty of opportunity for that to evolve in the way that the carbon markets have. I think that probably will happen over time. At Beta, we'd love to see the growers be durably compensated for the positive environmental impact that they're having. We have to be careful about making the ecosystem services markets the reason and the driving force. I think the driving force can and should be the ability of these practices to drive much greater profitability at the farm level by allowing the farms to be self-sustaining or more self-sustaining in terms of soil fertility and weed and pest and disease suppression.
How do you ensure that new practices make sense for an individual farm? There must be a danger of just regen for regen's sake.
And I think that's one of the reasons why adoption's been so low is that if you take a series of practices to a grower and say you have to do these things to farm properly, they will just know that that's wrong and they'll be right. And it's not that you're absolutely wrong in recommending those practices, it's just that the degree to which you use the various practices and how you implement them is going to be very dependent on the specific field and the soil characteristics and what kind of crops you're growing and the weather and a series of other factors. And so what they need, again, comes back to just good agronomics. What they need is science and data-driven support to figure out how to use these practices and optimize the use of these practices in every field across their farm, in every year that they're working with regenerative agriculture. They need to be able to do that in a way that makes sense. I think it's one of the challenges too. People talk about definitions in regen ag and practice-based definitions. It's I think that's one of the reasons why the industry has been very careful about that is because the use of the practices is so contextual, right? Context specific. And so that's where I fully agree. Regen ag for regen's sake is not the path forward.
How do we get the balance ultimately then of future profitability and impact that enables growers and farmers to take advantage of increased revenues, but at the same time developing the regen practices that we know are required for reducing impact?
I think it comes back to this trade-off idea. I don't think it is a balance. I think it's the more effective we are in using these practices to drive profitability, the better the outcome we're going to get in terms of environmental impact. That's a little bit of faith and just understanding these practices conceptually, but it's also what we're seeing on our farm and on the partner farms that we're supporting is that it's just extremely complementary and synergistic. And that's one of the things I absolutely love about the space and working in this space is that we can do what's right for the grower in terms of their financial well-being. And we can do that with confidence, knowing that what we're going to see on the other side is going to be more soil organic matter and soil organic carbon. We're going to see better water infiltration rates, and the water holding capacity of the soil is going to increase. These are the drivers of all of the other things that we're looking for from an environmental perspective. We need to not think about it so much as a balance, but actually think about doing these things really well. Because from a profitability standpoint first, because that's what the farmer cares about, what will make the practices durable and sustainable, and then just know and ultimately measure, know that there will be this environmental impact on the other side.
What do you think the future looks like? What are you expecting to see this whole sector evolving into?
I'm sure continue to see some fits and starts around scaling up programs. I have no doubt that it's not going to be a linear path. But I do believe that there's enough interest from the growers. There's continued interest and investment from industry and government. There's actually a tremendous amount of interest from the investment community in this space. And so I think what we'll see some consolidation, simplification from an MRB and standards perspective. You're going to see, I think, more companies approaching these regenerative programs with this kind of profitability mindset, farm profitability mindset. My hope is that as this really scales up, we'll hit a water, there will be a watershed moment in the coming years where people realize, no, this actually can have an impact on climate at the scale required to be able to move the needle. It's not just side projects for ESG reports. This is something that is actually going to make a dent in the overall climate equation.
Well, there's certainly lots of potential. It's going to be exciting to see what becomes reality. Mike Shoemaker, CEO of VIDAA, thanks very much.
Thanks, Ian.
As we know, tightening regulation is having an ever greater impact on company behaviour. I talked recently with Lisa Spica de Bevacqua, Global Director of Sustainability Consulting at NSF International, about how companies can tackle the challenges presented. Why don't you give us very quickly the sort of 2-sentence introduction to NSF?
NSF is a global certification, testing, and inspection organization. And I like to say that NSF is responsible for ensuring essentially that clean water and clean food is delivered to consumers all over the world. And we do that through a variety of methods, including offering a lot of different certifications that span food safety, water safety, and also actually environmental and generally sustainability certifications as well. That's a big piece of what we do. And then we have some advising as well to support everybody on that journey. And that's a part of where I live here in the organization and oversee our global consulting around sustainability.
We're going to talk a bit today about the rise and rise of regulation and impacts on business around the world. We're seeing a real rise in the impact of sustainability-related regulation on business in Europe and elsewhere. Why do you think this is?
I think that sustainability is just consistently higher and higher on the list of concerns for consumers around the world. And ultimately, governments pay attention to that. They understand the need to make sure that if this is a concern for the consumer, there needs to be regulation around that to ensure that, for example, the claims around products that are being made are accurate and that the consumer knows what they're getting. And frankly, as sustainability becomes more and more of a recognized practice, it's becoming more and more of a recognized business need to have really a sustainable future for the world. And I think governments are stepping in to help codify and protect that future legacy.
Why do you think that we've moved from a almost voluntary approach around best practice to now regulation? Do you think that companies should have been concerned about what they were wishing for?
Well, I think a lot of the companies who were crying out for more regulation ultimately were probably on the first tide of mission-focused companies who really wanted to see this embedded into the DNA of our society. And business is one of the major branches of our society, right? And how we live out our values or potentially can live out our values. So I would have a feeling that a big chunk of those companies aren't complaining because likely they already not only have good practices in place that are going to be somewhat in already compliance with these regulations, but they probably have reporting and management systems in place for it too, because it's been a priority for them for so long. Now, a lot of the companies that you'll hear crying uncle are those companies that perhaps are in the middle of adoption or the laggards of adoption of standardized and operationalized ESG practices in their company. And some of these regulations are going to hurt a bit in the sense that it's going to cause them to have different investments in their organizations from a systems monitoring approach, management systems approach, supply chain engagement approach, and so on.
What are the first steps companies should take to engage on these new and increasingly due diligence related pieces of legislation?
It's great that you use that phrase due diligence, because so many of these regulations, ultimately what it's about is reporting. And so if you're reporting, you need to know what you're reporting on, why you're reporting on it, where's that data going to come from? Is the data good? Who do you need to bring along in the process? So due diligence is really the backbone in many ways of compliance with these regulations, in addition, of course, to having the good practices in place that should be in place so that you're doing well, not simply reporting against it, but doing well. Really, regardless of the type of legislation, or the, let's call it maybe the topic of legislation, there are some first steps that really apply across the board. First and foremost, you really need to make sure you have your leadership's buy-in, the C-suite buy-in. Now, for the most part, with regulation coming into play, they're going to be on board with this, whether they want to be or not, because they'll need to be compliant with this legislation, right? That's beginning to be a little bit of an easier argument. Although for the last one or two decades, one of the key conversations in the sustainability world has been, how do I get my leadership buy-in? How do I make that business case? So that tide is turning a bit. Once you really made it clear and helped the leadership understand, if they're not already aware of the legislation, that's going to impact their business and their ability to stay open if they don't comply with it, then it's really about building the team that's going to be able to help collect the information and support this reporting, not just the reporting, but also development and implementation of the policies and procedures and best practices that need to be in place to really have an ESG or a sustainability program that's full of integrity and actual impact. And that team generally needs to be cross-functional. It's going to need to pull in people from all across a company, and frequently involves not just sourcing, but marketing, even quality assurance, certainly people from the finance and accounting division. Ideally, you really do have a dedicated sustainability specialist or manager or director, depending on the size of your company. And then many times also like an operations or facility type person. And last but not least, I believe I said procurement, but you want to think of it from a vendor management perspective as well as like supplier management. So just to emphasize that. So those are a couple of the key things. Make the case to the C-suite, get that buy-in, build your team. And then that's when the real hard work starts, which is beginning to gather the data that's going to be needed. To wrap that up, the first real step there is you need to identify, what are the questions we're going to have to answer here? What's the data that we need? And start mapping out how to gather that info. And sometimes that process is more complicated. Some of the questions are going to be a little easier.
There's a real alphabet soup of regulation coming into play. What for you are the key things that companies, particularly in the food and beverage sector, need to be thinking about?
So the areas that companies will need to be focusing on depend a little bit on the order in which they're tackling the different legislation and the reporting. But topically, two of the most important ones that are coming up are related to human rights tracking and then also climate action. Very specifically, those two come up, and also deforestation. So you're looking at deforestation, climate, which of course are related, and then human rights in the supply chain especially, but also within the company itself. The legislation that you see associated with that, of course, for the deforestation would be the EU deforestation regulation. From a climate perspective, there's a handful of them out there that are either voluntary reporting formats or, again, legislation that exists. So you can think of CDP when you're thinking of that. You can think of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, the TCFD, as some of the more voluntary ones. In the US, you've got the SEC climate disclosure rule. You've also got the EU carbon border adjustment mechanism, the UK climate-related financial disclosure. And then you go into the supply chain and the human rights piece, and you've got the Supply Chain Due Diligence Act out of Germany, of course. And then the CSRD, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, is really comprehensive because it basically says, well, anything you're not already reporting on related to sustainability, just make sure you're reporting on the rest of it. Okay. So don't miss any topics, get it all in there. Considering the fact that CSRD wants you to report on everything and that there are some existing specific regulations in the deforestation, human rights, and climate areas, I definitely would recommend looking at those three topics first, right? Because you're able to comply with more than one legislation at a time if you're addressing those to begin with.
So I asked the question guardedly, given all those bits of regulation just mentioned. What for you then are the steps that companies need to take to navigate their way most effectively through the challenges at meeting all of these?
We talked a little bit how to get started, right? And so just getting started, not being frozen, thinking, oh my goodness, how are we going to tackle this? You know, just get started, get that team put together. That's the beginning. In the medium term, it really is about digging into the data that's being collected, making sure that you're establishing systems for reporting that are going to be repeatable. So as you go through collecting the data the first time around, which is going to be the most painful, you're going to see there's gaps where you frankly simply don't have the information. Getting on the marathon shoes, right? Knowing it's not really a sprint, although that first push might feel like a sprint, but it's a marathon. You continue doing it year after year. Look for those areas where you're going to be able to improve your systems reporting to automate it a little bit more or make it a little bit more operationalized so that it's not such a heavy pull and push to get that reporting performed. And then you can really start looking at the qualitative aspects that are underpinning your ESG program and know that you're going to take that evolution of struggling to report, being able to report, and then really being able to improve and be able to take pride in that and know it's also making a difference as well as complying with just a regulation that's out there.
And I guess it's not just a marathon. It's a marathon that never ends, of course, is the challenge as well. Okay, let's think a bit of the challenges around firstly reporting and then action. What are the kind of typical reporting challenges that companies will face?
It depends a little bit on the size of the company, because with the size of the company, it's going to change the challenge a little bit. With a smaller company, frankly, it might just be struggling to find the bandwidth within a smaller team to absorb some of the labor that's going to be required to do this reporting. That's going to be one of the challenges. With a larger company, you can probably either find the funds in the deeper pockets of these bigger companies, usually deeper pockets, to fund a position that can really catalyze action, have more direct responsibility for the reporting. And that's helpful. But then the challenges they face is finding the right stakeholders in the organization to support their efforts, making sure they're on board, and then dealing in particular with the much larger supply chain that a larger company is going to have versus a smaller company. To deal really with that challenge of the larger supply chain, one of the key action that's going to need to be taken is mapping out your supply chain and trying to understand where all your products are coming from. Whether it's a product-based company or a service-based company, you know, so where are your services coming from or where are your products coming from? That's one of the biggest challenges we have in our globalized food system, because there are some direct relationships, but that tends to be the companies on the smaller side. And then the larger companies are working through brokerages or other mechanisms where they don't necessarily have direct contact with the raw ingredient supplier. And frankly, there might be some confidentiality in place between that final product manufacturer and where the raw ingredients are coming from. And they can't necessarily know that. But doing their best to bring supply chain partners along saying, hey, broker, you know, I know this is sensitive information, but we've all got to be reporting here, and finding a way to collaborate and break through some of those information blocks so that they are all going to be able to be covered and compliant with this legislation is really important.
See, we've talked about some of the reporting and need action challenges there for smaller versus larger companies. How else does that regulation typically impact bigger companies differently from SMEs, smaller companies?
In a larger company, it's a really big ecosystem. And in the smaller companies, it's much easier to know who needs to be involved. What are the processes involved, if any, with doing this type of reporting? So what I'd emphasize in this area here is that in larger companies, part of that group that's going to need to get put together in this cross-functional effort is going to include the legal team. And when that reporting is getting ready to go, you definitely are going to want to run past all the information that's being reported to your legal team. You know, there can be concerns about accidentally including confidential information or a variety of other concerns that that team's going to want to look at. And that's a step that sometimes companies forget to include in the timelines, and then they're pushed up against a deadline. So that's going to be a really important one. The marketing aspect that can roll out of this type of reporting is also something to consider for a larger company. When you're collecting all this data on the efforts that are being made to have good social and environmental practices, that is something to be celebrated and to help inspire additional action either throughout the industry, because you're leading by example. It's something that continues to re-engage an employee base and be able to believe in the work that they're doing at a particular company, whether they're directly performing that work or not. So being able to tell that story accurately and truthfully, it's also really important. It's great to take advantage of this reporting that's required legally to be able to insert that energy right out there into the industry and into your internal teams through a type of marketing reporting that's related to it.
It's easy to get quite intimidated by all of these issues, to think that, oh my goodness, this is all very complicated and very challenging. How am I going to deal with it all? It's easy to forget sometimes that there are still some relatively easy wins. How do you recommend companies look for these easy wins? Action I can make to demonstrate to my colleagues, this is why we should be doing this.
I don't know. Are there easy wins in this situation? I'm not sure. It really does take a bit of effort, right, to put all of this information together and to try to improve your sustainability systems. When you say easy win, it more makes me think about what's the smart way to approach this. When you're including the right people and prioritizing topics that hit on or address multiple pieces of legislation that you're going to need to be answering, that's a smart way to approach it, right? Because you're able to make an effort in one area and it's answering concerns across multiple areas. Looking at climate and, you know, your greenhouse gas emissions and having reporting there is really an important thing to start tackling, because that has implications on monitoring your energy use and can also help the bottom line of your company. Because if you're trying to reduce emissions and you're monitoring your energy use as a part of that, it helps you identify how you can be more efficient generally in your operations, which translates into bottom line savings. Looking at those areas like climate or looking at supply chain mapping that are then going to set the foundation to be able to take effective action across multiple other areas is a really smart way to start. And it is going to reduce the effort needed in the future if you start with those.
I guess a better question would have been, are there any relatively easier wins? And thank you for answering that question, which is perhaps the one I should have asked. You mentioned this earlier, quality assurance. How do companies best involve quality assurance processes when they're tackling these bits of regulation?
I tell you what, one of the most interesting things evolving currently, I think, in the ESG landscape is this unexpected ally with the quality assurance department. Why is that? Well, it is partly because of reporting needs. Even before the government regulations came out around reporting, you saw that companies were wanting to report. Many companies, to stay competitive and relevant in the marketplace, were beginning to report on their sustainability activities. But oh my goodness, you have to monitor that information. You have to track that information. And who better to monitor and track developments in an organization than that quality assurance group? They've got the discipline for that. They've already got existing systems in place. And I know years ago when I was working with one of my former employers, we were looking at scaling globally and did very successfully do so, essentially a triple bottom line standards and auditing system for their global suppliers, right? Making sure some specific environmental and social practices were in place. And even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, part of that quality assurance group was really key, because they would go out and visit suppliers and visit their vendors, and well, especially suppliers. You see them as really being an ally and being able to piggyback ESG reporting and monitoring on top of other efforts that they're already making.
Let's end by thinking about what's going to be coming up. What do you think the next generation of regulation would look like? I know we're going through an awful lot of regulatory change right now, but How will that evolve, do you think?
Well, a lot of pain points are going to be felt over the next 3 to 5 years in a variety of industries in trying to comply with these regulations. What I think is going to happen is you're going to see both more specificity in certain areas and less details in some ways in others, or perhaps less requirements in others. Right now, there's a lot of regs that are out there that say, and, you know, in general, broadly, you need to be reporting to these things, but it doesn't necessarily tell you how to do that. It doesn't tell you what's going to be acceptable. And maybe that will cause change in regulation, or at the very least, I know something that does happen here, for example, with the USDA is they might issue a regulation and then they begin to develop really strong guidance documents at a minimum to help people understand how to actually interpret and apply these regulations. So in the short term, it's very possible more of these guidance documents, more of the how-tos that has got either an implied or possibly an explicit endorsement from a government body will probably be the more immediate things that we see here. And just for example, with the CSRD, it's like, okay, well, you need to report on environmental matters, social matters, how human rights are respected in the supply chain, right? And just in general, what does that really mean? And then with deforestation, you know, a lot of companies, especially the larger companies that have those more complex supply chains, it's like, wow, well, okay, we've even mapped where this is coming from, but what's going to be the best way to report on this? What level of detail are you wanting to see? Those are, frankly, some big questions that are still out there. And as we see those companies work through that, probably leverage some government allies and connections to try to understand and work through this and communicate the struggles they're having, we're going to see more specificity in how to report, what to report on. And then perhaps certain aspects are going to be de-emphasized in reporting because they're finding it's just not realistic.
Completely agree. We're hearing a lot about companies needing to know the how-to, as you say, interested in wanting to engage on the new regulation, the EU deforestation regulation is a prime example, but there isn't enough information around as to how to properly engage in these bits of regulation. So I think for sure, you're right, that's going to be the next stage. Companies want to do this, but they'd really need to be sometimes led by the hand through it so that they get it right. It's been a fascinating conversation. Lisa Speaker from NSF, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Ian. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And I'm delighted that Lisa will be joining us at Innovation Forum's Future of Food Conference in Amsterdam next week on the 13th and 14th of May. There's still space if you want to join us. Full details on the Innovation Forum website, which is also where to go, as ever, for all the latest insights and interviews. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.